I'm Aisha Hauser. My pronouns are she, her. I have long, curly black hair with lots of gray streaks in it that tell a lot of stories. And I am the outgoing president of the Liberal Religious Educators Association. I want to give a very heartfelt and deep gratitude to the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association and Derek Jackson, Reverend Derek Jackson, for inviting us to join you all in Professional Days. So thank you very, very much. And I'm also very excited to hear Xiomara.
I am so excited for our keynote this afternoon. It has been a pleasure working with Dr. Xiomara Cervantes Gomez as we plan this keynote to really engage, help us really think about, we talk about inclusion, but what's next? That is not the end, but is in some ways just the beginning of our thinking. And so I'm not going to give a long introduction because I think Dr. Xiomara is going to introduce herself much better than ever I could. So we're going to invite Dr. Xiomara to come up and share with us her words of wisdom.
Hello, and thank you for all of your patience. I'm wearing heels, so I probably don't need this. I'm more than likely going to fall if I use it. All right. Hi, I am Xiomara Cervantes Gomez. You may call me Xio. I am tall, wearing a beautiful bold yellow dress, long black curly hair with highlights, and not enough coffee yet. So I want to get started today. Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me to share my thoughts, my ideas, my heart. I'm grateful to the UUMA, Loretto, and all of you for being here today. Thank you for your patience. And I'm going to move right along for us. I will preface by saying I will be discussing openly and honestly issues of racism, police brutality, transphobia, sexism, all the isms. Feel free to exercise self-care as you need, and here we go. I am a bruja, a curandera, a healer, an orator, a Chicana, Mexicana, artist, thinker, and transgressor. I am the descendant of slaves and mothers ripped from the Nahua and Tepehuan peoples. My matriarchs come from colonias of healers and liberators. And in honor and reverence of those who have come before me, those who have paved the path for me to speak before you today, those who have made a way for trans of color excellence, revolution, and intelligence, Mother Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, Miss Major Griffin Macy, Bambi Salcedo, Jenisette Gutierrez, Marcella Altus Reed, Maria Lugones, Ashe. Whew, what a decade we are in. May we not forget the haunting specters of 2020 that led us to the Confederate flag being flown for the first time in the U.S. Capitol building on January 6, 2021, all while images of domestic white terrorism struck an unsurprising shock on faces across the world. Yet on January 20th, people toasted on social media the inauguration of the first Black, Asian, and woman vice president of the United States and the new U.S. president. Repeating Vice President Kamala Harris's words, "We did it. We did it, Joe. You're going to be the next president of the United States of America." A turn of the decade, once defined by Time magazine as the transgender turn, with the statuesque Laverne Cox grazing the cover. From Carmen Carrera to Laverne Cox Janik Mock and Teek Milan, trans people of color have been visible in their embodied realities. And yet, for many people of color, we gathered at rallies and assemblies and demonstrations awaiting the charges and sentences of policemen in the name of racial justice and black life. But the U.S. boasted triumphant leaps in LGBTQ plus inclusion as President Biden reinstated anti-discriminatory policies for trans and people of color that were removed from the prior administration. This same year, we also watched the groundbreaking and historical TV series Pose on FX, produced by Janet Mock and Ryan Murphy. This took over televisions and computer screens across the globe, becoming three-time winner of the GLAAD Media Award for Outstanding Drama Series, while MJ Rodriguez swept the award for the 2022 Golden Globe for Best Actress in a TV Drama Series. This show brought together the trans-melanated excellence of legendary mother Dominique Jackson, India Moore, Angelica Ross, and Haley Sahar. In 2021, Lena Bloom became the first transgender cover model of Sports Illustrated's infamous swimsuit issue. Except our two early departed George Floyd's last words, "I can't breathe," define a call to action that Black lives matter and always will. In this last year, the rightful convictions of those who stole his basic human right to breath glared across headlines, while a plague of death became normalized in our contemporary present. The historical COVID-19 global pandemic of the early 21st century, yes, I said early 21st century, let's get used to it, surely will be in textbooks for several generations to come. While today, too many of us are still grieving the loss and suffering of our family members and loved ones. Mind you, we are only 2.5 years into this decade, not even a quarter of the way through the century. And already, 2023 has been contoured by policies restricting which bathroom I may relieve myself in. We've watched an attack on public literacy due to glitter, sequin, and Yas Queens. We've watched the refusal of the advanced study of Black cultural production in our schools. We've seen the politically sanctioned censorship of our cultural languages. So I ask, how did we get here? We are barely halfway through this year, and at least 16 transgender individuals have already been brutally murdered right here in the United States. Gwen Gatehood, Jasmine Star Mack, Casey Johnson, Tortuguita Terran, Olivia Snow, Maria Jose Rivera Rivera, from my current home of Chicago, Unique Banks, Avery Nicole Smith, Imanawitaho Zaki, Kashe Henderson, Kaylee Scott, Taseya Woodland, Ashley Burton, Rashida Williams, and the two unidentified victims from last week, we will call them our beloved, our remembered. I say your names, I invoke your names, and I conjure your memories so that we may honor you for the ultimate sacrifices you have made so that so many of us can stand here and appear before you today unapologetically, unabashedly in our truths. The average age of these human lives was less than 30 years old. In a time when aliveness, when breath is no longer our basic human necessity, surely then every breath a person of color, a trans person, takes is an act of revolution. As a queer, trans, Latina activist, scholar, and theologian, honestly, words I didn't even know I could put together, I begin with my own social location, not just for establishing my personal relationship with how I've come to experience my own otherness in the world, but rather it is through the intimacy of that otherness that became an impetus for working with and writing about these spaces. In my work, I centralize communities of color and transgender experience because they address my urge to search for new theological resources that enable me and teach me how to be in the world and how to be with others in their otherness. As a scholar, I study what bodies do and what is done to them as a result and critique of its existence. In other words, I begin here because it is what I know. Because these are the spaces that teach me something about being something rather than someone. I am in search of new theological resources in a time when the ones available have failed to provide an insufficient structure, have provided an insufficient structure that protects us from the harm and systemic oppression that it purports to liberate. Which is why I am interested today in what it means for collective liberation to prevail if we are caring for those whom we are ecclesiastically supposed to recognize as the other. So, here is our syllabus for today. I am a professor, I can't shake that. We are going to think about how structural and systemic violence is indelibly and inextricably linked to our roles as religious leaders, ministers in the pulpit, theologians in our libraries, religious educators in our communities. We are going to think about the need for collective liberation beyond inclusion and reconciliation. But most importantly, we are going to think about the effective responsibility to share our histories of those systematically erased from our archives, our texts, our memories. Today, we are moving beyond coming out narratives. We are moving beyond the question of the sanctity of our bodies. We are moving beyond the mass production of adversity victim narratives, because I stand before you today as a survivor of way too many disruptive situations and way too many at the risk of my own human life. So how are we going to get there? First, today we're going to address our thought patterns to redirect our thinking sideways. I want to move us beyond the binaries of a top-bottom, insider-outsider approach to ask of ourselves to look sideways and ask the most basic of questions. What? Just what? Perhaps we may already know why, because we witness how thinking functions and is performed in the world when it is now part of our daily lives, and our bodies surely never lose the sensations from where these cultural traumas manifest, and surely our memories never lose the sense of who. But rather than asking ourselves, who needs our care and protection in this world? Who needs our ministry? Who needs our collective liberatory practices? Rather, I want us to question, what is it? Today, we talk about ministry, a collective liberation, not for us, not even for them, but to the ecclesiastical responsibility to see them as an other. Today, we will also reconceptualize inclusive practices and what they look like for allies by thinking through, from, and against the Unitarian roots of the UU through the 19th century theologian Ralph Waldo Emerson. Here, we're going to rethink our role intellectually to underscore our own intellectual independence, self-reliance, and societal responsibility, dovetailing with our broader interest today to foster collective liberation for those whom the broader world has still not yet learned to care. To do the service of care, I'm going to compel us today to disinclude ourselves in our inclusionary practices. I'm going to explore how authentic identities are empowered and empowering and transform our communities. Finally, I want us to work together to map the coordinates of the barriers created by equality so that we may work toward engaged active advocacy to nurture and create the space for meaningful change. You know, the point of printing this is that I wouldn't lose my spot. So, for these ministry days, I was very blessed and grateful to receive the invitation to speak before you all today. And admittedly, like most speakers, the question that pops in your head is, what am I going to talk about? But I took this invitation as such a great opportunity to rethink the question of, well, what is ministry? How do we go back to that definition? This has paired along with the question I have struggled with for a very long time now. It's a question I'm sure you all have heard at one point or another. What is it? How do we talk about it? What a word, it. A word that truly says infinitely nothing and yet powerfully says everything. What is it? Is perhaps one of the earliest questions we once posed to the world, one that was mostly answered by what and what should not be put in our mouths. The question is always already asked, one we will continue to ask. The question reflects our ability to connect with the world, but what once meant explaining why one's foot doesn't belong in their mouth continues to evolve in its meaning as the body continues to grow in its experiences with what it comes in contact with. What is it? A question that has been posed to me and those like me for most of our lives. It is one of the most fundamental questions that has remained sustainable for the majority of our lives in this world. It will continue to tell us how do we make sense of our bodies and relationship to it. Whatever it is. You see, I don't recall the first time I heard it, or the first time it was used for me. Almost like it has always been around. For those of us who grew up not looking, sounding, talking, dressing, or living like those around us, that very familiar question haunts us today. What is it? Oh, that dreadful it. For me, it is a word that has haunted my recent history in very sinister ways that I've not been able to move beyond the restrictions of a gender binary. Among gender divergent individuals, it does provide an opportunity to think beyond the male-female binary, but how do we reconcile the thingness? Of course, though, we preoccupy ourselves with the ways the word resonates with a thingness or a not-human object. As history shows us, often the risk of being read as it presents its own harm and violence. I've asked myself then, what does it mean to talk about it if we accept the circumstances as part of our daily practices? If the primary issue is a thingness that we attach to the human or the not human, of that which it is, it exposes certain bodies to violence, death, and even disappearing without a trace. There is excellent work giving the needed attention to how we talk about the perpetuators of these forms of violence that occur against someone being an it, or at least legibly as so. This work has thoughtfully addressed the systemic conditions that permit structural order that determines which lives are worth protecting and which are not. But I have been thinking, what about the other part of the question? Let's assume it describes a thingness or a not fully human thing. Because, well, that's the problem, presumably. Well, in that case, I would like to follow through. I want to play the tape on that definition. Here is the okay and. In other words, perhaps it would be more generative to think what the implications, possibilities, and endeavors of being read as it. What does it mean to think with it? We obviously interact with it as it moves in material worlds we also occupy. We have an affective bond to it. We know that it's killable, but that must mean we must presume that it was once livable. Where did I put that clicker? This has brought me to the question then of the soul. As I revisited the question of what is ministry, we do understand ministry by definition to be the care for souls. Well, what is a soul? It is that thing we all talk about, describe it, we minister about it, we teach it, but what is it? We know it's inside of us. We try to protect it. We try to save it. But we do know it's not fully human. We do know that it is not fully the body, but is embodied. I foreground soul as a way to talk about it. The soul doesn't have to be alive to exist, which makes sense when certain lives are not even a requisite in the first place. We know the soul is that which is always already not going to be human, but embodied. But we can ask, is that embodiment exclusive to humans? Is it exclusive to living things? Is it exclusive to those breathing things? Like I said, we've all talked about it, and yet it remains unknowable, unintelligible, even if it's embodied. What we're talking about then is how we embody this thing that is a type of otherness that already comes to us, that thing we talk to, that thing we talk about, that thing we invite other people or other forces to impact and have an influence. The soul has become that thing that we've spent centuries debating whether it exists or not. But we know, secular and religious, the soul is that thing we are trying to protect and save. We must assume then that this thing we call soul is seemingly important, seemingly worth protecting, seemingly sacred, but most importantly, it's capable of being diminished. We've described the soul in very different ways: dark, shining, bright, illuminating. Ministry then is the care for souls. So if we care for the souls, the question is, well, why do we care so much? See, the question of caring for souls has particularly affected me when it's come to those who don't agree with my embodied reality and want to give me Christian scripture. To wit, and remind me of where my afterlife may take place. Too often, though, I ask the question, when was the last time you woke up at 3 a.m. and said, oh my gosh, Yomara's gonna go to hell? You don't. I'm hoping you don't, at least. But we care. People voice that they care about your salvation, your soul. Why? You see, for ministry, the soul is not this novel or special, unique way of understanding humans and their experience. We've talked about it ad nauseum. What it has done is it's provided a useful language to talk about the work that we do. It's provided a language to describe the sacred worth and sacred power of everything that occupies this earth and beyond. What ministry teaches us, then, is how to say all the right things about it. If we think about the soul as that thingness that's not human, we can describe the soul as an it. In that sense, it teaches us how to be with it. The result is treating others like they are special, unique. But that's so contrary to what the soul is if we know it's not new or unique. The soul occupies our bodies, but we know it's not the body itself. We know it's not human. So what do we call this body? Is it an entity? A shrine? Coffin, a vessel. What is the most appropriate way to describe this container for life and death? Its permanence is infinite, but its permanence is also finite. It always remembers. It will always already have been necessary to our relationships because there are limits to what it enables us to do and whether these relationships can even exist. You see, the thing with ministry is when I was called to ministry, I knew it wasn't the pulpit. I thought academia was my ministry, which just sounds stressful, but as I rethought what my role is as an academic, a professor, a theologian, my role is to learn. My role is to think. That's what I want us to do today. I'm also trying to be cognizant of our time, folks. I want us to rethink this definition of ministry as a care for souls. And instead, redirect our attention then, well, I'm gonna get back to the soul in a second. Never mind, can we rewind a few slides? We'll stick there. Let me go ahead and talk about the soul by the definitions we've known then by religion. I've retired from Christianity, so I've been searching for new theological resources because the ones that are available to me no longer suffice. They no longer provide me a life I want to live. So I've turned to some unlikely resources, for me at least. One began with Islam, as I began thinking about how do I talk about the soul? How do I talk about the soul in ways I haven't? Islam provides two different ways of talking about the soul. In the Quran, we have the ruh, which is that divine breath of life. This translates in the Quran as spirit. It's a consciousness. That thing we call the quote-unquote soul, but here we're talking about that spirit, that essence, that thing that makes us know we exist. As opposed to the not, which we do know then that that thinking, that intellect that is in here becomes immortal. It drives everything else. Related then to the naf, which is the self, the ego, our psyche, our soul. Here we are talking about the mortal parts of us, our disposition, our characteristics. We often see then how the two definitions come into play. Dark soul means bad person, sometimes. Plato helps me out a little bit here, so I'm going to bore you with some classical philosophy. So Plato tells us that the soul is this thing that's incorporeal and provides eternal support to our body, but it's not the body itself. It's not corporeal, but incorporeal. Likewise, Thomas Aquinas does say that the soul is not corporeal, but he does push that a little bit further to tell us that the soul doesn't rely on our body. As a matter of fact, it can exist without us. It does exist without us. Plato very nicely organizes this into three levels of the soul. I'm sure we've heard at one time or another. To remind us, logos refers to our mind, reason, and intellect. The thymus being our emotion and spirit, which is what we tend to focus on in our ministerial practices. And eros, we know as love and desire, but it's also our appetite, that craving. I find Plato to give us a very useful way of thinking about the soul that I want us to follow today, because for Plato, logos, thymus, and eros also capture the societal structures and social caste systems of our society, where we privilege the mind over our desires, where we privilege what we think over how it makes people feel. So how do we take each aspect of the soul in our context today? Today, the soul is a useful way to describe that thing that is part of everything or everyone. But it's that thing we know we can't ever fully talk about. It's infinite in its definition. Like it, it infinitely says nothing, but it means everything. Today I approach this through what we call an apophatic approach. Apophasis is the ancient tradition of saying and unsaying whatever the divine is. Because once we say what the divine is, we've already named what it's not. When we say what somebody is not, we are eliminating possibilities of what they could be. I want us to think about that duality today by asking ourselves, how do we care for those that are not human? Or at the very least, not fully human. Today I'm going to redirect our attention then from the thymus that we know very well to think about the logos, our mind, our reason, and the eros of the soul, our desire, our appetite, and the connection between the two to try to have a relationship with our current material world. Okay, I think my phone came out of the back. Okay. Well, I'm not sure where my slides are now, so I'll just keep going for us. So let's dive into a ministry of intellectually, move into a ministry of caring for it, that logos. The soul demands us to think. It is part of that thing we've started calling our intellect. It's that thing that informs who we are, that thing we're supposed to feed, nourish, teach, minister to. Somehow we've understood that the soul can receive information, that it can be transmitted cultural memories of how we survive in this world and how it may also prosper in this world. The soul truly invites us to rethink thinking, a right to think. Recently, I've been thinking about our right to think negatively in a world that's painted by death as a norm, violence as a norm, loss as a norm. Is it not our divine right to be upset at the world? Is it not our divine duty to feel anger for the soul of others, to think negatively? To think negatively is thinking about what gets done means all the other things that are not done. It means thinking about what's missing that restricts the possibility for other things to come into existence. We're called then to care for people's thoughts, for the way they think, which is a huge task. We can't always control what someone else is thinking, though we may try. To do the work of caring for thoughts, we assume then that their spirit has had experiences that require thinking and rethinking. We're called then to do the work of caring for those negative thoughts, to care for those thoughts that aren't heard, to care for those thoughts that have experienced spiritual violence, those thoughts that are still in spiritually violent relationships. So, what fascinated me a lot about the worship today were the references to climate change and to detainees. Two things that affect me very personally and closely, as I'm sure it does with many of you. As I watched the video of QDEP, I was taken aback by what I think the queer means in detainee work, and to realize that ministry work is queer. See, queer, yeah, it's the non-normative, but that's a little too easy. Queer is when our thoughts have become political issues. Queer when our beliefs have become a threat to other people simply because of our embodied reality. To think with our detainees is to think with new theological resources. To think with our climate as it changes, we have a world that is changing its thoughts for us. We have a world that is changing what our current material world will look like. So why do we not learn from it? Or when we do learn, sometimes we learn a little too late and we end up with a lot of other problems, such as my home state being under fire for about 9 months out of the year, California. I want us to think about a ministry that calls us to care for it. To revisit, slide, where it is we are getting this information. I want to revisit the institutions of where we're being taught these thoughts about the soul, where we're being taught to minister in the first place. A church, a prison, a school, the sidewalk. Sure, we know these sites as our ministry sites, but do we think about them as places of learning? If we're preoccupied with thinking with the soul, well, let's return to where did we learn these things? How were we taught to think? How were we taught to learn? You see, teaching we often associate with institutions. We think of schools, universities, seminaries. But let's revisit that. Because yes, seminary and university does teach a thing. Someone's being paid to do that. But let's rethink the church. And by church, I mean our sanctuaries. You see, the church is a site of education. We go to church to learn. We go to church to learn how to be in the world, how to be with others, how to nourish ourselves so that we can be with others. You see, the church is the location where we teach people how to be in the world with others. But it is not the space we are called to minister. That is, those spaces with souls that need care. The church is where we're willing to have our souls fed. The church is where we come for that information so that we may take it into the world. If we think about the benediction that comes with services, the idea is to go out into the world and spread love. The work we do here is not our ministry. Ralph Waldo Emerson describes then the minister as a scholar. The role of a minister is teaching. It's pedagogical. We're teaching people how to be in the world with their own otherness, but most importantly, with the otherness of those around them. I want us to briefly think about Emerson before we move on to our break. So for those that have moved on and not thought about Emerson in a while, I apologize, but I'm gonna try to make it as accessible as possible. Emerson's essay, The American Scholar, which was a keynote address that I imagine took a lot of patience to listen to 19th century English at that time, but it becomes this seminal work to discuss community building, ministry, and the role of social justice. Community building. Emerson approaches the question of community building by naming that we are already in a fragmented society. He writes, "The state of society is one in which the members have suffered amputation from the trunk and strut about so many walking monsters, a good finger, a neck, a stomach, an elbow, but never a man." You see, what we have described here is that dismemberment of the thing we're too comfortable calling a body. Paul the Apostle once described that we who are many form one body and all the parts become one. A little reductive. My neck is not the same as my arm. They both do different things. They serve different purposes, but most importantly, they can be injured in very different ways. So if we use the metaphor of the church as the body, not only is that a bit ableist, but there are limitations when we think about bodies in general. We assume that this has an expiration date. We assume it's going somewhere. We assume it's destroyable, which means each part is destroyable in its own right. Which means thinking then sideways, looking to our left, looking to our right, realizing that I'm unique, but having a body is not unique. Having a soul is not unique. Rather, Emerson tells us, quote, "I embrace the common. I explore and sit at the feet of the familiar, the low." When we come to our congregations, we come with a willingness, an eagerness, an anticipation. But when we step out into the world, do we step in with the same curiosity? Do we step in with the same concern for our soul's nourishment? Or have we stopped and paused to think about what feeding the souls of others might mean? You see, we've created this idea of feeding souls, which Emerson once described in the early 20th century when he wrote this essay, that what we're experiencing in the church is a famine of the church because of the lack of feeding our souls. In many ways, we can see how that might still be the case. There are certainly many souls that go unfed, unministered to. But that famine, as we think about today, as I heard all of us speak, it warmed my heart with joy. I was happy. I love seeing rainbows and people gathering. Who doesn't? But is it enough? Is that really the low? Is that the familiar? Are we really doing this only for us? You see, the importance of ministry is thinking about the importance of ordinary life. Being called to think about why this world operates the way it does. Thinking about then what our role is in society as an individual who thinks individually. We come into ministry wanting to care for a collective body and often neglect that. Often in a whole body, we forget those other parts that need our attention. How do we listen to people who are ministering us? In the description, I saw you saw me describe this as a glutton of inclusion. I've been attracted to gluttony lately. It's that thing we've often thought about with the seven deadly sins as this overeating and exuberance. Yeah, it can refer to that. See, gluttony reconnects with Plato's idea of the eros. It speaks to an uncontrollable appetite, an uncontrollable desire. You see, what's sinful about gluttony isn't that you're overeating. It's that you're overtaking resources that you don't need. It's creating an abundance of resources that will go to waste. I'm always empowered and moved when we speak inclusively, when we use words like queer, when we use acronyms like BIPOC. And as I think about everything I named in my introduction, where is the disconnect? How did we get here? How do we listen to those people whose souls remain hungry? How do we listen to their soul growling? I push us then toward ministerial intellectual independence, to think for ourselves, to give ourselves the power to trust thoughts. Emerson wrote, "Man's thinking must not be subdued by his instruments. Books are only for the scholar's idle time. When he can read God directly, the hour is too precious to be wasted in other men's transcripts of their readings." In other words, we could read all the texts and religious scriptures we want They're always gonna say the same thing every time we go back to them, but that person on the corner who does not have a home to sleep in tonight, their words change every day. Yes. How do we think with ordinary people? Books were there to inspire us, to teach us. And sure, many of us may know the right thing to say at any given time. But that is not the direct communion we have with truth. The scholar of the first age received into him the world around, brooded thereon, gave it the new arrangement of his own mind, and uttered it again, is what Emerson tells us. This is where I push back on Emerson, as Emerson rightfully needs. As we think about our relationship to truth, the problem is that we're calling it truth. But doesn't mean we have to call it a lie. You see, lies also bear a truth. The truth is, it has to be a lie. It has to assume that there is some truth. As we know, there may be no absolute truth, and that is okay, because we're not called to think with truth, we're called to think with the possibility that truth may never come. We're called to be actively engaged so that the soul, when it is activated, can respond to absolute truth and utter its non-existence, but rather to create something else. Truths have failed us in this world. We know the numbers, we know the statistics, we know the death tolls. We take those moments of silence. We bow our heads for prayer. We ask for time to stand still so that we may catch up with the world. As we break for lunch, I want us to sit with that idea of, as we nourish our bodies, how are we nourishing our souls of others? Not in this space. Not in your communities, not where you hold your ministry, as you call it ministry, but everywhere else. What does it mean to show up in your ministry, to show up for souls? So meditate on that, and I will see you all after lunch.